Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about the life of a truly remarkable character, someone who may be familiar to you if you have read about Chinese history and culture, particularly the involvement of Westerners in Chinese culture. But to other folks, his name and his life may be new to you. His name is Joseph Needham. He was a British biochemist who fell in love with a Chinese woman, and as a result of that, he fell in love with China and with its culture and science and history. He believed that the Chinese had been responsible for many of the world's scientific innovations, things like printing and the compass and explosives and suspension bridges and a lot of other things. And not only were they responsible for these innovations, they developed them often hundreds of years before the Europeans said that they had done the same. And his effort to support this belief became his life's work, the 24-volume Science and Civilization in China. This morning, in this part of Focus, we'll talk about the life and work of one of the 20th century's greatest China scholars, and our guest for the program is Simon Winchester. He is an author, a journalist, a broadcaster. He's been a foreign correspondent, mainly for The Guardian and The Sunday Times, and has reported from Belfast and Washington, D.C., New Delhi, New York, London, Hong Kong. He's written for a number of American and British magazines and journals, including Harper's, Smithsonian, National Geographic Magazine, Spectator, Granta. He has authored a number of books on a wide range of subjects, including The River at the Center of the World, which is about China's Yangtze, Krakatoa, The Day the World Exploded, about the explosion of that volcano in 1883, Crack at the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906. The book maybe he's best known for is The Professor and the Madman, which is about the making of the Oxford English Dictionary. And he is the author of a brand new book that is about the life of Joseph Needham. And the title is The Man Who Loved China. The subtitle is The Fantastic Story of the Eccentric Scientist Who Unlocked the Mysteries of the Middle Kingdom. And the publisher on the book is HarperCollins. It's out now in bookstores, and he's been good enough to spend some time with us to talk about the book. He's joining us by phone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their comments brief so we could keep moving along. Anyone who's listening is welcome to call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Winchester, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
A great pleasure.
I appreciate it. And it's my understanding that, in fact, you were introduced to Needham through one volume of this multi-volume set about China's history of science and technology in China.
Yes, it was about 15 years ago. I was writing a book about the Yangtze River. And as many of your listeners will know, I'm sure, this river, which is one of the longest in the world, nearly 4,000 miles long, is squeezed for about 300 miles of its length through a very narrow set of canyons known as the Three Gorges. And in those gorges, the river flows with an astonishing ferocity. And yet, for hundreds of years, sailing vessels managed to get up this river against these astonishing currents. So I was talking to someone one day here in New York about how on earth these boats did it and what kind of design the junks, the sailing junks, would have had to have had. And he said, this person, well, the one authority, the book you should look at, is Volume 4, Part 3 of a book called Science and Civilization in China, by a man called Joseph Needham. I'd never heard of Science and Civilization in China. I'd never heard of Joseph Needham. But the following day, I was at a bookstore in Salisbury, Connecticut, one of those stores that has everything and the owner knows everything about books. And I said, Mike, I said, have you ever heard of a book called Science and Civilization in China? And he looked at me as if I was something that the cat had dragged into the store. He said, you do, of course, mean Joseph Needham. And I said, yeah, I think I do, Mike. And he said, you mean you've never heard of Joseph Needham? And I said, I'm awfully sorry, I haven't. And he said, well, shame on you, he said. Joseph Needham was the greatest Englishman ever to have visited China. And over his life, he created the biggest, most authoritative, longest book ever written about China in the English language. It's 24 volumes long. We never get complete sets, even though they're still in print. They would cost thousands of dollars, but we occasionally get single volumes, and I think we've got a single volume here. Well, he went downstairs, like the White Rabbit, and came up with the great tombstone of a book, blew the dust off it, and lo and behold, it was Volume 4, Part 3, the one I wanted. And I sat in the car outside looking at this massive tome, everything to do with China's relationship with water. So it was lighthouses and canals and navigation and the rudders and anchors and the use of the compass and the very designs of the boats that I was looking for. And I thought, who on earth was the chap that put this together? Because not only did he put this book together, but if Mike McCabe, the bookseller, was to be believed, 23 other volumes of similar authority on astronomy and mathematics and ceramics and engineering. Who was this guy?
He was born in 1900, lived to be 94. So right there is an amazing fact that his lifespan virtually took him through the entire 20th century.
Yes, and one might say he was kept alive on a diet of ginseng pills and chain smoking. He smoked like industrial Pittsburgh. It was quite amazing. But he lived an awful long time. He was all sorts of other things. He was a nudist. He was an accordion player. He was a wild dancer. He was a brilliant scholar, and he was a great womanizer. Mm. And he was married to a woman called Dorothy, who, like him, was a biochemist. And their lives would have probably unrolled in a fairly ordinary Cambridge intellectual way. But everything changed in 1937 when he met a young and very pretty, very clever Chinese woman student called Lu Guizhen. And he fell in love with Guizhen, and everything changed. Hmm.
This one of the remarkable things here is the relationship that he had, Needham had, with his wife, Dorothy, and this woman who was his lifelong companion. And apparently the relationship between Lu Guizhen and Needham was at least something that Dorothy was okay with. That seems like a remarkable level of understanding to me.
Yes, I mean, when they married in the 1920s, Joseph said to her, this is going to be a thoroughly modern marriage. We are going to pursue other interests with other people if we wish to. And Dorothy, I think somewhat grimly, accepted it. There's no evidence in her diaries that she ever strayed, but she certainly tolerated his straying, and he strayed in spades. He, from the moment he came back from the honeymoon, I think he was interested in other women, and it was not unsurprising when this rather pretty and very brilliant Chinese woman came into his life that he fell in love with her. But what actually happened was that it was different in her case, because the day that the relationship was, if I can put it as bluntly as possible, consummated, which was in February 1938, she taught him the first ever character in Chinese that he had ever written in his life. And he was so fascinated by it that he decided that he would learn Chinese from her, and he did. He took 3 years to do it, but by the time the 3 years were up in 1940, he was fully fluent in first written and then later spoken Chinese, and in doing so fell in love not just with her, she was called Lu Guizhen, not just with the Chinese language, which he became very competent at, but with China, and he remained completely fascinated and enraptured by China for the rest of his days. Mm.
That story, it's so cinematic. It's such a remarkable story, this story about how apparently the two of them had made love and were lying there in the afterglow having a smoke, and Needham apparently turned to her and said, and they were smoking, and he said, almost sounding in a rather offhand way, he said, well, how would you write that in Chinese characters?
Right. And she showed him, and it's two characters that the words are fragrant smoke. And she wrote it down for him, and he copied it. And you see in his diary, first in pencil, and then finally committing it when he's got the confidence in pen, this pair of characters. And he said, I'm smitten. I'm smitten with this language. And he said, from that moment on, he was immersed in the glittering, crystalline world of Chinese ideographic writing. And he never looked back. Mm. From that moment on, he never stopped being a biochemist. But from that moment on, China took center stage.
And certainly, we should not underestimate the difficulty of this undertaking, learning written and spoken Chinese. This should tell you something about his mental acuity, the fact that he could do it, he could take it up so quickly. He apparently had a kind of idiosyncratic way of going about it that was rather unlike the kinds of ways that other scholars would approach trying to learn the language. He managed to do it in a relatively short period of time.
He did. I mean, he created his own dictionaries. He had the facility which really guided this ability of his was a truly photographic memory. I mean, if I can just step back for a moment, to remind everyone how brilliant he was an embryologist. His field of study was the egg and the development of, you know, how a chicken egg turns into feathers and bones and all the rest of it. He had written in his late 20s a 3-volume book on embryology, chemical embryology, which is still available. And he used to proofread it by, first of all, reading the proofs and then going to bed and looking at the proofs in his mind. And he could conjure up every page. So if he looked at page 153 in his brain, he could see what he remembered, a spelling mistake here, a drawing that wasn't completely finished there. He would correct them in his mind, note them down on a notebook, and then when he was bored with doing that, would translate the whole thing into French and do it all over again. So he had an extraordinary facility, and learning Chinese when you've got a photographic memory is somewhat easier than if you don't, and I don't, for instance, and I find it terribly difficult.
Yeah, you know, given that he seemed to have his parents were much more conventional kind of people than he was, one wonders how exactly it is that it turned out that he was, I guess I find myself using again the word unconventional, and no matter what he did in his life, you would think that he would not follow a kind of a normal path.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I'm not sure that his parents were conventional. His father was very conventional. His father was a bit stuffy and a bit boring. He was a doctor. His mother was completely mad, from what one can gather. She was drank hugely. She had astonishing rages. She consulted mediums and held seances and believed in ectoplasm and spent money like a drunken sailor. I mean, she was a very difficult woman. So much of and the fighting between she and her husband fought all the time. Heaven knows how they managed to conceive a child, but they only conceived one. And they disagreed about what he should be called. Mother wanted him to be called Terence. His father wanted him to be called Noel. So they called him Noel Joseph Terence Montgomery Needham. And he just chose Joseph as in the spirit of sort of filial compromise. So it was a pretty unconventional beginning, and the rest of his life, with all its eccentricities and oddities, I think followed a path that was firmly set in that house in London where he grew up.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Simon Winchester. His new book is The Man Who Loved China. This is a biography of a man named Joseph Needham. He was a British chemist, educated at Cambridge, an unconventional and brilliant man who fell in love with a visiting Chinese student and was in love with her and had this relationship that lasted throughout their lifetimes, even though Needham was also married. It was as a result of that chance meeting with this Chinese woman, Lu Guizhen, that he became fascinated with China and Chinese culture and went on to spend a lot of time in China and writing about it, and as a result produced this monumental multi-volume series of books, Science and Civilization in China. And if you'd like to read about it, it's a great story. You can go out and look for the book. And questions, welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Certainly his meeting with Lu Guizhen was very important and introduced him to the things Chinese. Maybe then the next important thing was the fact that he was chosen by the British government to go to China. This was during the Second World War, go behind the lines and to provide aid and assistance to Chinese scientists. How did that come about?
Well, we've got to remember that in 1937, the Japanese launched a full-scale invasion of China. And there were these terrible atrocities, things like the rape of Nanking in 1937 was one of the most appalling atrocities of the entire World War. by the time Needham was learning Chinese over in Cambridge and was thinking, gosh, one day I'd love to be able to go to this remarkable country, the Japanese had effectively occupied the eastern third or the eastern quarter of China. And one of the things that had happened, which I think is going to one day be the subject of a book, I think it's a wonderful story to write, is that all the big universities in eastern China, which had been desecrated by the Japanese, upped sticks and moved all their professors, all their students, all their blackboards, all their library books, all their laboratory equipment, put them on the back of donkeys, and with these donkeys, the students and the professors walked across China, sometimes thousands of miles, across the plains and the deserts of China, over the mountains to reach the comparative safety of cities in the west of China, places that have been so badly affected by this recent earthquake, cities like Chongqing and Kunming and Chengdu and Changsha, where they could be safe from the Japanese attacks, and they could set up the universities anew as sort of refugee universities. Well, although both the British and the Americans were notionally neutral in this war and didn't go to war with the Japanese until after Pearl Harbor in December 1941, the British in particular were very sympathetic to the plight of these universities and said, and Winston Churchill particularly said, we've got to support these people. We've got to help them in their hour of need. Otherwise, all intellectual life in China will just die. We need to appoint a scientist, preferably someone that speaks Chinese, who will go to China, although it's going to be very, very difficult and traveling is going to be very dangerous for him, and go there, find out what they need. And we maintain an air bridge. The Americans essentially fly the planes between Calcutta and Kunming in the west of China, and we can supply them with whatever they need. So let's send someone. So in 1942, they selected this tall, sort of Harry Potter-like figure of Joseph Needham, because he spoke Chinese, sent him on a ship through the Mediterranean, down through the Suez Canal, Bombay, Calcutta, gave him a military uniform, armed him with a revolver. I mean, he was a Cambridge academic. He'd never touched a revolver in his life. But they did that because it was dangerous. Sent him, flew him to China. So he arrived and he spent the next 3.5 years there having the most extraordinary adventures, finding out what these universities needed, ordering it up from London, and helping to save Chinese intellectual life during the war.
Mm. I need to pass on some weather information to folks who are listening this morning, because we have had some heavy rain here this morning in our part of the state, and we do have some severe weather here, so I want to make sure that people know about it. The National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for eastern Morgan County, Sangamon County, eastern Menard County, and southern Logan County, and this will be in effect until 11 o'clock. At 10:20 this morning, National Weather Service meteorologists detected a line of severe thunderstorms capable of producing damaging winds in excess of 60 miles an hour. Some of the locations impacted include Middletown, Athens, Alexander, Williamsville, Sherman, New Berlin, Franklin, Elkhart. Also included in this warning, Auburn, Beeson, Chestnut, Cornland, Divernon, Iliopolis, Lincoln, Lomi, Mechanicsburg, Mount Pulaski, Murrayville, Pawnee, Riverton, Rochester, Springfield, Waverly, and Chatham. And so if you are in the path of the storm, you should get ready for damaging winds and deadly cloud-to-ground lightning. If you're outside, get to a shelter, preferably inside a strong building, but stay away from the windows, and remember that severe thunderstorms may produce tornadoes with little advance warning. So once again, this is a severe thunderstorm warning, and it's for eastern Morgan County, Sangamon County, eastern Menard, and southern Logan. That will be in effect until 11 o'clock this morning. We will try to keep you up to date here on the weather, because here this morning, and I think also later this afternoon, we're expecting the possibility of some severe weather in our listening area, and we want to make sure that people know all about it. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, again, is Simon Winchester, and we're talking about his book, The Man Who Loved China. It's about the life of Joseph Needham. At what point did Needham start to become interested in or consumed with this idea of wanting to document and understand Chinese technology? Particularly, his idea was that, you know, not only did the Chinese develop this, have this very highly developed technology, but that it was a long time, it appeared it was a long time before a lot of these things showed up in Europe. At what point did that bug sort of grab him?
I think on almost the first day he was there. When he left for China, he left in the latter half of 1942, he had seen his mistress, Gui Jen. She, at the time, had gone off to America for a while, and they met briefly in New York. She said to him, look, Joseph, you're going to a country that is regarded with widespread contempt in the West, but I want you, when you go there, to keep an open mind, because I and my father, her father was quite a distinguished scientist in eastern China, are convinced that the Chinese have a long record of invention, which you, Joseph, having an inquiring mind, should at least keep an open mind about. Open your eyes, see what you can see. So he went there with this in the back of his mind, and on the very first day, it was a spring day in early 1943, and he was in Kunming, a beautiful city just down from the Tibetan hills, which were covered with snow in the distance, and it was a beautiful blue morning. He sat smoking a cigarette, watching an old gardener top-grafting a plum tree, and he watched him idly, and after a few minutes he thought to himself, the way this gardener is grafting this tree is very different from the way that my father used to graft his trees back in our garden in London. Maybe the Chinese do things differently, and as far as horticulture is concerned, and maybe also they've been doing it for far longer. So he started speaking to the gardener. He was the first Chinese man he'd ever spoken to, and he found that his language was sufficiently good that the gardener could understand him, and he could understand what the gardener said in reply. So he made some drawings, and he made some notes, and then went to the archives, which he could read, because, of course, he could read Chinese ideographs. And he found out, after he had sent a few telegrams back to London, that this technique of grafting trees had been invented, or clearly had been born in China, hundreds of years before records show that it was developed in Europe. And this started him on this path of inquiry. What else, he thought, had the Chinese created first? And he began to assemble a list, and the list, by the time he had died in 1995, was pages and pages and pages of hundreds of things that the Chinese had created first. The plum grafting technique was the first one, but it went on to things like the stirrup and gunpowder and printing and the use of the compass, bridges, chains, ventilation fans, blast furnaces. It was quite an extraordinary list, and it was all began with seeing this man in the garden in 1943.
Let's talk with the caller. We have someone in Champaign, line number one, right here. Hello.
Thank you. Curious about a couple of things. One, I'm assuming he must have written a volume on Chinese medicine. And two, how did he negotiate relations during the Cold War, when things were pretty bad between Communist China and certainly the United States? But I mean, England may have had a different relationship, but still they were basically, in hostile governments.
Well, it's a very good question. Let me dispose of the easy one first of all. Yes, indeed, he did write volumes on the history of Chinese medicine. And indeed, one of the subjects, there was a subset of his interests. It was devoted entirely to the history of acupuncture. It's got a rather nice title. I think it's called Celestial Lancets. So Joseph Needham on medicine, Joseph Needham on acupuncture are two very well-known volumes of this masterwork. The question about his relationship during the Cold War is also easily answered, perhaps not in a way that some people will find palatable. He was an ardent socialist. He had been intellectually very much affected by the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, and although he was never a paid-up member of the Communist Party, he was unashamedly a Marxist, and he believed for all of his life that the Communist Revolution in China in 1949 was a great thing. This led him into all sorts of problems, which maybe we can discuss in a few moments, but intellectually, he was very much of the left, and as a result of that, he was banned from this country, from America, for 25 years, and only came back to America in 1978 after the University of Chicago awarded him an honorary degree. So during the height of the Cold War, America was very hostile to him. They feel very differently today, but in the 1960s and 70s, he was having a very hard time for his views.
Pardon me again for jumping in here, but some more weather information I'd like to bring to people. Now the Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for the following counties: for northwestern DeWitt, northern Logan, eastern Mason, Tazewell County, western McLean, southern Woodford, and southeastern Peoria County. This will be in effect until 11:15 this morning. Again, a line of severe thunderstorms capable of producing destructive winds in excess of 70 miles an hour. So do keep aware of the weather if you're in some of the locations covered by this warning. And again, we'll try to bring you just as quickly as we can whatever information we have. And do, of course, keep in mind the fact that severe thunderstorms can and sometimes do produce tornadoes. So this is a severe thunderstorm warning for northwestern DeWitt County, eastern Logan County, eastern Mason County, all of Tazewell, western McLean County, southern Woodford County, and southeastern Peoria County, and that will be in effect until 11:15 this morning. And we continue to expect that there will be severe weather here moving throughout our area for the late afternoon here and possibly also later in the afternoon. Late morning here and later in the afternoon. So just as soon as we have that kind of information, we'll bring it to you. And once again, just let me introduce our guest, Simon Winchester. He's authored many books, including The Professor and the Madman, probably the one he's best known for, about the making of the OED. Also, The Map That Changed the World, Krakatoa, and A Crack at the Edge of the World. That's about the great San Francisco earthquake. And he's also been a documentary maker. He's been a foreign correspondent. He reported from many places around the world for The Guardian and The Sunday Times. He's contributed to a number of American and British magazines. And his new book is The Man Who Loved China, The Fantastic Story of the Eccentric Scientist Who Unlocked the Mysteries of the Middle Kingdoms, published by HarperCollins, and has just was published last month. And it's a good story, so you can find it in the bookstore. And questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. What did the Chinese make of Joseph Needham?
Oh, they adored him and adore him to this day. He's not terribly well known in the West, and part of my intention, I think, in writing this book was to return him to the position of honor that I think he rightly should occupy. In China, there's no need to do such a thing because every educated Chinese knows his name, his Chinese name, that is, which is Li Yusi. Li Yusi. If you said to any school child in China, he'd say, oh yes, Li Yusi, the most famous Englishman that's ever lived in China. He taught us about ourselves. This was the extraordinary thing, that these books brought together knowledge which the Chinese didn't really know about themselves. They just had a sort of vague awareness that they were scientifically superior, but to actually have it put down on paper and in an organized manner was something that they are tremendously grateful for. So they showered him with honors officially, but he's taught. I mean, the book is translated into Chinese, and the other day I ordered out some Chinese food in Washington, D.C. I mentioned to the delivery man that I was writing a book about Joseph Needham, and he looked completely blank, but then I said, Li Yusi, and he said, you're writing a book about Li Yusi? I said, you know him? He said, of course I do. Every educated Chinese knows Li Yusi. We're so pleased. And he was fascinated when I brought him back to the apartment, to my wife's surprise, and show him all the papers and books about him. He's revered in China.
Another caller here to talk with, someone in Lovington. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
How did he have time to write all these books, or how did he dictate them? How did he put them in print?
Well, he did them all on a Royal typewriter, and he would just work all the hours that God gave him. And I should mention, incidentally, talking about reference to God, as well as being a Marxist, he was also a devoted Christian. So, and he preached sermons, and he was very much a keen member of his church in a village near Cambridge. And so that intellectual dilemma, between Marxism on the one side and and a deep belief in Christianity on the other was something that also informed his life and made it even more complicated. But how he had time, I mean, I don't know how any human being could do it. He was clearly superhuman, but no, it was, he didn't dictate it. He wrote it all himself. And, I mean, he had assistants to work through certain specific areas of which he had very limited knowledge, but he was the architect and he was the builder of nearly all of it.
Thank you.
And I, maybe, again, we should mention that this was a lifelong project. He lived to be 94 years old, and apparently he continued to work on this throughout his entire life. I think actually some of the volumes were published after he passed away.
Yes, I mean, he had finished, by the time he died in March 1995, he had completed 17 volumes, which is pretty amazing. But since he died, there's an institute called the Needham Research Institute, which you know, where all his papers are, and researchers are still working there. They're getting, basically their funding is from the Mellon Foundation in the United States, most of it. Seven more volumes have been published since he died, making a total of 24, and there are four more to come. So by the time the project is totally complete, it'll be 28 volumes. I mean, absolutely vast. If you compare it to the runner-up, which is the Cambridge History of Modern China, that's, I think, 11 volumes. But this, single-handed, 28.
So was my understanding that you're after the book about the making of the OED was published, The Professor and the Madman. It was actually good for sales of the OED. Do you think now you're going to be end up boosting sales of science and civilization in China?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I hope I'm not talking out of turn here. I approached Oxford when I was writing The Professor and the Madman. Of which I have to say, I had no clue at all that that book was going to do at all well. But I wrote a sort of fairly modest letter saying, "Dear Oxford University Press, I'm writing a book about your dictionary, and who knows, maybe it'll sell one or two copies, and possibly you'll sell one or two additional copies of the OED as a result." Well, the book was this most extraordinary success, and they have sold thousands of copies of the OED as a result, so they're quite pleased with the way the things turned out. So I thought I'd write a similar letter to Cambridge University Press, and I did so about 6 months ago, and they didn't reply. And I was astonished, and I wrote again, and they still didn't reply. So this went on until about 2 weeks ago, and 2 weeks ago I wrote an exasperated final letter saying, you know, I did try, and I don't imagine the world is going to, you know, buy thousands of copies of Joseph Needham's book, but you might sell a few dozen. Maybe I should give up. And then they said, "Oh my God, we're so sorry. We've been having meetings about this. We just never wrote back to you. And now we're absolutely on board, and we're going to start selling it very aggressively, just like Oxford did." So who knows? That may happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with another caller. This is someone in Champaign, and line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. The question had to do with the political loyalties, and I wondered if, given the way you described those, whether Needham had connections with this remarkable group of Marxist historians, I guess many of them in the Communist Party's historians group, but maybe some of them not, Hobsbawm and Thompson and Rodney Hilton and people like that, or whether he was a bit more isolated in terms of the way he went about his work?
I think he was rather more isolated. He did have a lot of contact with that group in Cambridge who were known as the Apostles,
yeah,
and of which Kim Philby, of course, the noted spy, was a very prominent member. But I think he always felt that most of them were somewhat aristocratic, and there was a social distinction. I mean, it's ironic, is it not, that the most ardent and traitorous in terms of British law at the time, communists in Cambridge in the 1930s, were very well-born Britons. And Joseph was not. He was middle class. His father was a doctor. His mother was this Irish singer. So I think he always felt, although he taught Philby, I mean, the two of them met each other. I don't think he ever was part of that circle. But I think it's worth mentioning a little about the ban on him that got him into such trouble. He was invited back by Zhou Enlai. He became a great friend of Zhou Enlai, and he knew Mao Zedong quite well. They invited him to China in the 1950s, 1953, to investigate reports that were then current that the Americans had used biological weapons during the Korean War. And he put his signature to a report of an international committee of scientists saying that the Americans were guilty as charged. Well, this brought the wrath of England and America down on him like you wouldn't believe. He was nearly dismissed from his Cambridge College. He was nearly stripped of his fellowship of the Royal Society. And America banned him from 1953 to 1978. So 25 years he felt the harsh edge of the Cold War. And when he realized later, it's a long and complicated story, that he had actually been duped by Moscow and that he was used as a tool of the Moscow propaganda machine, I think he was very ashamed of what had happened.
But you'll note that he maintained a certain status in England and retained the position at Cambridge and continued to do his work there, and the political atmosphere, however bad it was, sounds like it was a bit different than it was in the United States during the McCarthy years.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And there is, of course, a final irony to this whole story, which is when he did come back to the United States in 1978 at the invitation of the University of Chicago, he gave three speeches in Chicago in April of 1978. The second of them was on Chinese gunpowder and early Chinese explosives. And sitting in the audience, unknown to him, was a young man called Ted Kaczynski, who 6 weeks later exploded the first crude bomb based on a design that Needham had drawn on the blackboard that day and embarked on this sad career of being the Unabomber.
Well, thanks very much.
All right, thank you for the call. We have another caller here. We'll get to in just a moment. I would like to just recap real quickly what's going on with the weather here this morning for people who are listening. In this part of Illinois, we have had some severe weather, and we're expecting throughout the day the possibility of more. So just let me bring you up to date. There is a severe thunderstorm warning in effect for Sangamon and southern Logan counties, and that will be in effect until 11 o'clock. So that's for about another 10 minutes. There is also a severe thunderstorm warning in effect for northeastern DeWitt, northern Logan, and western McLean counties, and that will be in effect for another half an hour until 11:15. There is also flash flood warning in effect for Douglas and northern Edgar counties, that one until 11 a.m., and there is a tornado watch in effect for a large part of our listening area, including Champaign, Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Logan, Macon, McLean, Moultrie, Piatt, Sangamon, Shelby, and Vermilion counties. And that will be in effect until 11 o'clock, so about another 10 minutes on that one. And that is the one that says that the conditions are favorable in and close to the watch area for the development of tornadoes. And we have had some severe thunderstorms, and they certainly can give birth to tornadoes. So you want to keep aware of what's going on with the weather. One more, an urban and small stream flood advisory in effect for Macon County. That's until noon. So stay tuned here to AM 580 throughout the day as the weather develops. We'll just keep you up to date on what's going on with that. And again, here to introduce our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Simon Winchester. He is an author, a journalist, a broadcaster. He's authored a number of books. He's written for a number of American and British magazines and journals. He's been a foreign correspondent for The Guardian and The Sunday Times. And his most recent book is about the life of Joseph Needham, and the title is The Man Who Loved China. It's published by HarperCollins. We have another caller here to talk with, someone here where we are in Champaign-Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. Comment on some other inventions, like they use bamboo pipes for drilling, and also made discoveries related to calculus. And how did he study languages, like use a tutor? And can you spell out his transliterated name, and how did he choose that name?
Yes. Li Yusi is L-I, which is the nearest approximation that Gui Zhen gave him his name, I should say. So Li is like the first syllable of Needham. I mean, my Chinese name for Simon Winchester is Wun Simia, so Wun is for Winchester, so Li is for Needham. And Yusi is actually the nearest transliteration of the word Joseph that was given by the Jesuits, was used for the Jesuits, I should say, in the 16th and 17th century. So L.I. is his surname, and you, sir, is Y-U-E-S-E, Li Yu, sir.
And just to backtrack a little bit, the caller was asking about how it was he learned. His initial introduction to Chinese was by this woman who came to be the student and with whom he fell in love and had this lifelong relationship, Lu Guizhen. But it seemed like she was his first tutor, but that much of his learning of the Chinese language was self-taught. He taught himself.
Well, yes, but also there was the considerable assistance of the then professor of Chinese at Cambridge, a man called Gustav Halun, who, in an act of enlightened self-interest, was working on the translation of a 7th century Chinese manuscript and said, well, let's co-opt Joseph Needham to help me translate it. And so that's, I mean, no better way. It's rather like Mao's dictum of learn to swim by swimming. Joseph Needham learned to translate by translating. So come 1941, I think, 3 years after he had started learning, he had a vocabulary, if I can put it that way, of more than 5,000 Chinese characters. And by the time he had finished helping Gustav Halun do the translation and had at the same time been learning how to speak the language with Guizhen teaching him the dialect of Nanjing Mandarin or Putonghua, he could speak it pretty well. I mean, it wasn't until he arrived in China in 1943 that he could really put it to good use. But he did have this ability. I mean, beforehand, he could speak 7 languages. He wrote Latin and Greek. He could speak French, German, Spanish, Polish, and Russian. So he was a very good linguist anyway. And even though 37 years old, managed eventually to master Chinese also.
We talked about the fact that he was responsible for this multi-volume series, Science and Civilization in China. I think you said that by the time that he died, there were 17 volumes in extant. And so we could talk for a very long time about Chinese technology. But maybe just again for the caller, can you mention a few other things, perhaps things apart from those that we often hear about, like gunpowder and the compass, some other sorts of technological achievements?
Yes, well, I mean, the stirrup, I think, is the thing that perhaps most profoundly changed at least mankind's ability to wage horse-borne or horse-mounted war. Bridges, I mean, what's known as the segmented arch bridge, which was a far more efficient form of and lasting form of bridge than anything that the Romans had ever come up with. The chain, ventilating fans, variolation, that's inoculation against things like smallpox, blast furnaces, the early formulation of crude kinds of steel. There was even a suggestion that in the 4th century they managed to make some kind of flying machine. They were aware of the shape of the aerofoil and of the Bernoulli effect and the fact that moving an aerofoil with power through the air will induce lift, and they had apparently created something, although it's often said that the inventor of that in the 4th century was then assassinated. The invention, if it ever was created, certainly terrified some people. The use of the compass, the printing, of course. I mean, we assume in the West, do we not, that it was Caxton or Gutenberg in the 15th century, but we now know that the first printed document using movable, admittedly wooden, not metal type, was printed in 868 AD, that's 600 years previously. Things like the game of chess, playing cards, toilet paper even. I mean, there's an order for perfumed squares of soft paper for that particular bathroom purpose, an order placed in 1340, so long before the Charmin Corporation or whatever it is, Procter & Gamble, came along, the Chinese were applying it to their sensitive parts.
Yeah. Needham, there was one very large question that preoccupied him that apparently came to be known, some people called it the Needham question, and that was why it was, given the fact that going back into antiquity, China had this very highly advanced civilization with a very highly developed science and technology. Why it is that modern science was born, it would seem, in Europe, and why it is that at this point that Needham went to China here in the 30s, that China compared to Europe was in, it would have been in some people's estimation, so backward. Did he ever actually come up with an answer to the Needham question that satisfied him?
Well, in Volume 7, Part 2, which was the last, which was destined always to be the last of the volumes, and which he was working on when he died in 1995, he does answer or address the Needham question. People aren't entirely convinced. I mean, there are many reasons given. It's always difficult to prove a negative. Why did the Chinese not advance? It's easier to say why the Europeans did advance. And the general answer to that is that there was so much intramural competition in Europe, in Western Europe, for instance, that if, let's say, a Spanish sword maker in Toledo had made a blade with a particularly sharp edge, and the Spaniards at the time happened to be at war with the Dutch, then it would behoove the metallurgists of Amsterdam to create an alloy which would hold an even sharper edge so that their swordsmen would have an advantage. This kind of competition and hostility breeds technological innovation. In China, it was just one vast, essentially unified country under the Imperium of Beijing. There wasn't the kind of internal competition which would lead to this kind of innovation. And in addition to that, it was the ambition of every young Chinese man not to become a scientist or an engineer or a merchant, but to become a bureaucrat, to become a mandarin, to run the country and to run it along the same lines that had been run for the previous 15 centuries. And that air of stability, which was so central to all Chinese people's ambition, led to a period of no innovation, compared at least to that that was going on after the Renaissance in Europe. But one final thing needs to be said about that, which is that although that clearly was the state in China in the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th century, it's not the case today. China is suddenly on the verge of her own Renaissance, and the universities are brimming with brains and ambition now. The number of patents being registered by Chinese scientists is ticking upwards again. So it's beginning to look as if, yes, there was 300 or 400 years where not much was happening. But in the vast sweep of Chinese history, that's a relatively small period, a hiccup, if you like. And if that is the case, then the Needham question is essentially moot.
Some more weather information here for folks. The National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for northern Shelby County, Moultrie County, Christian County, Macon, and also southern Piatt County in central Illinois. That'll be in effect until 11:30 this morning. Locations impacted include Maroa, Harristown, Forsyth, Taylorville, Stonington, Oriana, Decatur, and Blue Mound. This storm has a history of producing widespread wind damage across Sangamon and Menard counties. They say, that is, the Weather Service says, it's an extremely dangerous situation. Seek shelter now inside a sturdy structure and stay away from the windows. Report any severe damage to your local emergency manager, the nearest law enforcement agency, for passing them on to the National Weather Service. And again, so this is a severe thunderstorm warning for northern Shelby County, Moultrie, Christian, Macon, and southern Piatt County. This will be in effect until 11:30 this morning. A lot of severe weather in our area this morning. We'll do our best to keep you up to date. We'll try to get real quickly one more caller in here, and this is line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed reading your book. I just finished it. But there's one area there is no mention of anything dealing with travel or exploration of the Chinese.
Yes, and it's good of you to point it out. I have to here publicize, perhaps I shouldn't, but it's the same publishing house as mine, so I'm sure they'll be very pleased I'm doing their job for them, a book coming out from Gavin Menzies, who you may remember wrote 1421.
Yes, I've read that.
Right. Well, this, I believe, is called 1434. Comes out later in the year, and it is about specifically that, the effect of China on the European Renaissance, and that, of course, is reflected in much of the travel conducted by people like Cheng He, the famous Muslim eunuch admiral that set out and went, as far as we know from the documentary records, at least as far as Mogadishu, and perhaps rather further than that, and brought a a giraffe back for the emperor, which somewhat terrified the emperor. So I don't deal with travel, no, because Needham didn't really deal with it, except insofar as he dealt with the compass and navigation. But how far they got, I felt, was somewhat outside both the remit of Joseph Needham himself and also of the story that I felt competent to tell.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, we're just about at the point here where we have to finish. We've talked about the fact that certainly the Chinese know who Joseph Needham was and that people who study Chinese history perhaps do. Do you think that that now, maybe as a result of the man who loved China, that Needham will be getting a little bit more of the recognition that he's due?
Well, I hope so, and he's such a remarkable chap. I mean, he's just like, you know, Harry Potter on speed, and he was tremendously enthusiastic about everything, and he fell in love with this woman and fell in love with China and told us what we now need to know, because one, the mantra that sort of occupies me at the moment is a sign I saw in China recently outside the Chinese Space Center. In English, it said, "Without haste, without fear, we shall conquer the world." Well, an ominous-sounding thing. I'm not sure it's quite as ominous as it's meant to, as it looks. But if these people are going to become so important, we should get to know China as well as Needham did. So I think Needham will become much more well-regarded and well-known. And I hope if my book plays a part, then all well and good.
And the book is The Man Who Loved China, published by HarperCollins, by our guest Simon Winchester. Mr. Winchester, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, too.